I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. He was Commander-in-Chief during our victory in Desert Storm. He vastly improved our relationship with Russia, yet George H.W. Bush could not win a second term in office. Today we examine the 41st president with scholar and author John Robert Green. While his foreign policy included many successes, key domestic issues, including appointing Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court and the phrase, "Read my lips," impeded his campaign. Then Brian McTavish presents a summertime weekend to-do list as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The first President Bush won the Gulf War, oversaw the dismantling of the Berlin Wall, and watched as communism crashed and burned. Not a bad legacy, but it wasn't enough to win re-election in 1992. Bush, of course, lost to Bill Clinton. So you wonder, what happened? What went wrong? Why couldn't George H.W. Bush, the man with the most exhaustive Rolodex perhaps in American history, win a second term? Our guest today offers one explanation. The Bush campaign of 1992 may have been the worst-run presidential campaign in American history. John Robert Green is author of The Presidency of George Bush, and he speaks tonight at the Kansas City Public Library as part of its Hail to the Chief series. John Robert Green is a professor of history and government at Cazenovia College in New York, and so good to have you, Bob. Welcome,
Steve,
to Kansas
City. Steve, it's
great
to be here. Thank you.
The worst run presidential campaign in American history.
Did I say that?
Yeah, I think you did. What happened?
The campaign fell apart after the war, actually. They had so many things going wrong.
Yeah.
Lee Atwater, who had run the campaign in 1988, died of a brain tumor.
Yes.
John Sununu decided that he was going to take Air Force One and sell his stamp collection all over the place. They had to axe him. But there were other more subtle things. Bush was not a pliable candidate mm-hmm. in 92. He had mm-hmm. been diagnosed with Graves' disease. You might remember that he went to Japan and vomited all over the prime minister.
That's right.
Which was the first indication
that something
of this
wasn't
disease.
Right. Yeah.
And there was this wonderful moment in the campaign. I was sitting in a classroom with Cazenovia College students, and we were watching the debate. I think it was the second debate. They all blend together in stupidity, you know, after a while, presidential debates. And Clinton was up, and it was that moment where he got out of his chair that everybody was making so much a big deal out of, mm-hmm. and he was prowling the stage. And Bush turns and looks at his wrist.
Yes.
And
yes.
looks at his watch.
I remember it well.
I jumped out of a chair. I'm screaming and yelling. It's over. This campaign is over.
They you knew right away.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. We college professors live under the conceit that we're right about everything all the time. But it really showed that Bush was completely out of touch with his campaign. And for George Bush to be in touch with a campaign, he had to have a good handler.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't. They brought in Jim Baker too late. Everybody had either died, left, or been fired. And Clinton was able to stay on message. It's the economy, stupid for
that
whole
it.
Campaign.
Well, in fact, they couldn't get Jim Baker, and before they finally brought him in,
right.
the guy who was running the campaign for a while was named George W. Bush, who
That's
later
right.
became president.
That's right.
It's in your book.
Mm-hmm.
How well did he do at running his father's campaign?
He was in terms of concentric circles, if you think of distance from the center, George W. Bush was not immediately close to the center. His father brought him in when the campaign started falling apart mm-hmm. and asked him to quote-unquote fix it. But we're talking about a kid who had never run a campaign before. He had worked for his dad a little bit and run the Texas Rangers and had been beaten in a congressional campaign.
Yeah.
He just simply didn't know what he was doing, and it was more inexperience than anything else. But it was W. who said, "We've got to get Jim Baker." in here. And it was just too late.
Yeah, I love this one passage from your book. You say that George Bush wasn't very good at attacking the Clinton-Gore team.
Right.
You write that when he did go on the offensive, he often sounded shrill. I think we all might remember that. At one point, he said that his dog, Millie, knew more about foreign policy than those two bozos talking about Clinton and Gore. Not exactly a presidential way of attacking the opposition.
And Gore came back.
Bozos.
Gore came back and responded by saying that he left his clown suit at home. That was one of those moments where if you look back at the tape, Bush just looks exhausted. And he said something foolish when he was exhausted. He would not have done that. He would not have been allowed to do that had Lee Atwater been alive.
Mm-hmm.
He was just that. He was simply not well served during the campaign.
And talk about Lee Atwater again. He's one of those names that political insiders sort of remember. But he died in 91, of course, just a year before the reelect. Who was Lee Atwater, and why was he so important to George Bush in 1988?
Lee Atwater was a true fire eating. Fire-breathing believer.
Crazy man.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
If you remember, if any of your listeners remember Lee Atwater, they might remember him for famous photos of playing the guitar with George Bush.
Making that funny face to Bush, Bush is making the funny face back.
He was an unrequited child. I think that Bush felt that he was, the prodigal son in politics, but he was very well trained.
I didn't mean literally. He just was
not at all. He came across
frenetic.
He came across that way. He wanted to come across as the guy who would push the nuclear button any minute.
Mm-hmm.
And he had trained with a man who knew that well, Strom Thurmond in South Carolina. Lee Atwater was the one who brought attack politics to George Bush's bag of tricks. It was Lee Atwater who decided to go after Bob Dole in a set of ads that Roger Ailes did in New Hampshire saying that Dole wanted a tax hike. Dole didn't want a tax hike, but it was too late.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was Lee Atwater who gave the final go-ahead to the Willie Horton ad. And this was the type of campaign that George Bush, on his own, was incapable of running.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the only, I contend, and once again, college professors are geniuses. I contend that if there had been a negative campaign in 1992, if Bush had brought up the problems that Clinton was having with Jennifer Flowers, if Bush had called Perot on the ridiculous attempt to try and get the MIAs out of Vietnam, he would have won.
Yeah.
But nobody was telling him to do that.
And that's why these people are so important. And a lot of listeners will remember that during his presidency, after the successful Gulf War, George Bush had an approval rating of like 90%. So to lose that kind of standing with the American people and then to lose re-election just months later, that's quite a feat.
It was the biggest drop in Gallup history for a specific period of time. He went, I think, from 87% down to the 30s just over the summer of 1991. And the two things that precipitated that, the first thing was the economy and the recession, and Clinton picked up on that. But the second thing was the belief on the part of the American people as they came out of the war that the war hadn't been won. Now,
it was too easy.
Right. This sparks a lot of controversy when I say that the war, we didn't win the first Gulf War. But Brent Scowcroft agreed with me, and Bush kind of shook his head, in exasperation when I asked him the question. The question, of course, whether we should have gone into Baghdad and whether we should have tried to catch Saddam Hussein like we had Manuel Noriega. There was a lot that Clinton got onto, that Gore got onto, and, of course, Perot beat Bush senseless with it. And his numbers started tumbling.
That he didn't finish the job you're saying. He didn't go into Baghdad and eliminate Saddam Hussein and eliminate the army.
It was peace with baggage. I mean, it was not the type of peace that you could run a campaign on.
But Bush had his reasons for not going into Baghdad, which, Bob, were what?
One word, Noriega. He had already gone through the pain, the embarrassment with a brand new chief of staff, Colin Powell, a brand new team of trying to catch Manuel Noriega in his own capital city. And you might remember that they had to Manuel Noriega ended up holding himself up in the Vatican embassy, and they took, I think it was Aerosmith music or something, and they're blasting it at him to make him come out. just imagine any parent out there, you know, stuck with your kids' rock and roll music, full blast, you'd want to give up to the Marines too. But it took them 2 months to do that. The only thing, and Scowcroft said this to me, and so did Cheney, the difference was that there was no street-to-street fighting in Panama City. They could have gotten Saddam Hussein, but there would have been street-to-street fighting. We saw that in the second Persian Gulf War. Mm-hmm. And you know, to a certain extent, Bush is proven to be – first Bush is proven to be right on that. But they knew in the White House that they didn't want to go into Baghdad. They didn't want to spend that time on it.
And they didn't want the responsibility of then running a country in the Middle East after they had taken it over.
They had absolutely no exit strategy because they planned on exiting in 100 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of the Vietnam syndrome. We win. We go home. We have a parade and we get reelected. And he didn't stop to think about the Kurds. He didn't stop to think about giving Saddam Hussein back the helicopters. And it boomeranged on him. It was not a good piece to run an election campaign on.
We're talking about the presidency of George Bush this morning with the author John Robert Green. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza. Go to kclibrary.org for more information about that. Again, Bob speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the one on the Plaza. You know, there was another big issue when it come an impediment to George Bush when it came to getting reelected, Bob, and that was this. Read my lips, no more taxes pledge that he gave so famously. He broke that pledge. Take us back to that time. Why did he make the pledge and then why did he break it?
Well, he made the pledge because Peggy Noonan wrote the line. And Peggy said in her autobiography that she wanted something that was decisive. She wanted something that would take away the wimp issue.
And she delivered that.
Yeah, I'm going to play the clip back tonight when the thousands of you out there come over and storm the Plaza Library to hear me talk tonight. Play the clip back. The place goes crazy, and they're chanting, woof, 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 woof. And so the line was perfect. Then you get into the reality of what Reagan left behind. And Ronald Reagan, no matter how you feel about him, how you feel about him as a president, how you feel about him as an icon, Ronald Reagan left behind debilitating deficits that made it impossible for George Bush to do virtually anything in terms of domestic policy. And by the summer of 1991, you know, he's about to face a war. You know, so there's going to have to be an increase in defense spending. So they have to do something to pull the deficit in line.
Mm-hmm.
So Bush goes in. He got a pass from Danny Rostenkowski in the first year. And Rostenkowski said, you know, I'm not going to call for tax hikes, but this is the only year you get. Next year I have to call for revenue enhancements.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush knew that. And he came out for something, maybe it was revenue enhancements that he called it, some cockamamie term that really meant tax hikes.
Mm-hmm.
And this was to balance the budget. You know, this was to balance the family checkbook. It was responsible politics. And it was responsible government, which, of course, gets you nowhere. And out of right field comes Newt Gingrich, who wants to become Newt Gingrich superstar.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting moment where Bush goes out to announce this deal, and Newt Gingrich walks out on his president, just leaves. He doesn't go to the photo op. And you see the other Republican leaders going, what?
Hmm.
You know, and he goes and he submits his own plan that is – not fiscally relevant, that is not good politics for the Republican Party, and it's not good economics, but it doesn't have a tax cut or a tax hike, I'm sorry. And Gingrich, in a sense, won that battle.
Yeah.
Because when the New York Post comes out the next day and there's a banner headline that says, read my lips, I lied, you know,
it really caves into the president's campaign.
Yeah. Oh,
Tom sent us an email at updatedatkcur.org, and he asked, what does Dr. Green think about Grover Norquist's claim, the famous fiscal conservative, that Bush lost the election because he raised taxes?
I think Tom's got a point, but only part of a point, because like 1988, policy issues were not huge in the 1992 campaign.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't lose it as much as Clinton picked up on that and stayed on message. Perot wasn't even on the planet. you know, in 1992. You couldn't tell what he was going to do. But Clinton stayed on the economy. I think a study was done of Clinton's speeches during the campaign. He only talked about foreign policy when he absolutely had to. It was all on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't so much the tax hike. Now, the Republicans Norquist is correct, and so is Tom, that the conservative Republicans abandoned Bush. I mean, the person who really beat George Bush in 1992 was Pat Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
Buchanan wins the New Hampshire primary, or comes very close to winning the New Hampshire primary, and he just siphons money off from George Bush and stays in right down to the final moment. And Buchanan is being egged on by conservative Republicans like Gingrich.
So. Again, we're talking about the presidency of the first George Bush with John Robert Green, author of The Presidency of George Bush. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, we're being tough on George Bush in the first 15 minutes of our conversation here, but you wind up this book talking, Bob, in fairly positive terms
right.
about this man and his presidency. Why did you come to that conclusion?
I came to that conclusion actually through a back road. If Americans were asked to list, and they have been, their favorite presidents, the ones that they feel to be the most successful, the list is populated with familiar faces, but not faces that I would suggest should be there. For one, for Jack Kennedy.
Okay, sure.
And they're activist presidents. You know, they come out, they do a lot of bully pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
They're very charismatic. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Jack Kennedy, Ronald Reagan. Sometimes Bill Clinton's thrown in on that list. And you look at it and say, what American people really want, you know, in terms of a success, is for their president to be a table-pounding Teddy Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
I walked away from looking at George Bush, and I saw a very deliberate, patient, prudent, thoughtful leader who left the country as good as it was, maybe not better in some areas, but as good as it was in terms of the hand that he was dealt when he got the presidency in 1989. And he is still ranked by historians in the middle of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And I contend that that's because historians and Americans, you know, want their president to be Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was an abject failure as president.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I mean, from top to bottom,
right.
Jack Kennedy was a failure as president.
Bay of Pigs and lots of things.
Oh,
yeah.
you can make that kind of a list. And I think when you look at Bush, he has what I call a balance sheet. You know, there are things that didn't get done. There were things that did get done. There were some marginal successes like the ADA, the Clean Air Act.
Americans with Disabilities Act.
And I think reasonable people, even though I came to the conclusion that we didn't win the Persian Gulf War, reasonable people can disagree and say that we did win that Gulf War and it led to some stability. He gave Clinton a much better economy. But he had when George Bush got behind a podium, he just turned people off.
Yeah.
I asked him, I said, what did you think about this, the vision thing and stuff? And he just looked at me and he says, I hate labels.
Yeah. He didn't have a vision. He was upfront about he didn't have a vision.
He didn't think that a vision was the job of the president of the United States.
You have to sort of adapt to circumstances, he says in here. Yeah.
John Sununu told me in an interview that they talked early in the administration about the possibility of labeling the domestic policy. And they went through New Freedom, New Deal, all these things. And they just looked and there wasn't any aha moment. They just knew that Bush would sound stupid, you know, announcing that kind of thing. So,
you know, he was sort of sandwiched in the middle between these two-term presidents.
Activist
Ronald
president.
Reagan, Bill Clinton, both activist presidents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can't help but look at Reagan. Bush obviously was his vice president for both of his terms. To what extent does Ronald Reagan overshadow George Bush and sort of never really give George Bush a chance in a sense?
Well, the Reaganites certainly believe that he overshadowed him. The first thing that Bush does when he comes into the White House is tries to throw out all the Reagan appointees so that he can have his own administration.
Mm-hmm.
The Reagan people hated George Bush. Nobody hated George Bush more than Nancy Reagan hated him. And so there's still a lot of bitterness there. But I think you bring up another very important point. We as Americans tend to look at one-term presidents as less successful than two-term presidents. And that's nonsense, because there are reasons that George Bush lost in 1992 that have nothing to do with what he did as president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That's like saying, you know, somebody got fired for taking home office supplies or something, but they worked there for 4 years, so let's ignore all that and their failure because they pilfered Xerox paper.
Well, even there's this new book out, The President's Club, which talks about even the presidents themselves, when they visit, there is sort of this pecking order between the two-termers and the single-termers, and the two-termers are the cool guys, and the single-termers are the guys who we'll talk to later sometime.
Fascinating book.
Yeah.
There is that club. Mm-hmm. There is that club. I guess the best way to illustrate it is to take a look and see how infrequently President W. Bush has criticized President Obama.
Yeah.
And once you get into that club, and it's a club that's dwindling right now. The senior member of the club is President Carter.
That's right.
Who nobody likes. And that is very unfortunate, because there's another example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jimmy Carter,
the guy who did some stuff and no one really recognizes it today,
because he got his brains beat in by Ronald Reagan for very understandable reasons with the Iranian hostage crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a look right now in college textbooks, Jimmy Carter and the Iranian hostage crisis. That's how the section is always labeled. And that's just very short-sighted.
What do you think of the presidency of the first George Bush? 816-235-2888. Was he a success? Was he a failure? What do you think? Again, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Sean from Bayshore. Sean, good morning.
Good morning. Actually, I was looking forward to this conversation. I was hoping I didn't miss it, but I just really just caught it right on the radio. But I had a few questions for your speaker today.
Yes.
I'm not going to be able to make it to the Kansas City Library to witness his speech. But at the same time, though, I had a question in regards to the career of George H.W. Bush before he became president.
Ah.
Now, as far as his affiliation with the CIA before, you mentioned earlier about the failure of Jack Kennedy in 1960 to 1963. I've been doing some personal research on, you know, the Kennedys in regards to what was going on in the time of Dallas when he went to go speak. Just curious, where was George H.W. Bush on November 22nd, 1963?
George H.W. Bush was in Texas, but not in Dallas. And I'm sure that your research is referring to this picture now that is floating around on the net that shows a person who looks a great deal like George H.W. Bush in Dealey Plaza the day of the assassination. I certainly wouldn't want to speak with authority, but I will speak with great comfort in saying that that is not George H.W. Bush.
Well, and in fairness to George Bush, he had perhaps the greatest resume
One
of the greatest resumes in the history of American politics for the presidency. He did all kinds of stuff before he became president.
Yeah, and I can respond to that by just saying a little bit about George Bush's CIA director. He had taken over the CIA. The caller seems to have done his research on this. He took over the CIA after the CIA had taken the blame for a lot of stuff under the Kennedy-Johnson administration, and there had been several committees, the Church Committee, and Bill Colby, who was the head of the CIA, sold out secrets and everything. Bush came in and stabilized the CIA before Admiral Turner came in, and he did a very good job at that. George Bush was a career government servant. He did an adequate to good job at everything that he did before he became president.
He once was head of the Republican National Committee.
That's right.
Imagine
yourself. You got to defend Richard Nixon, for crying out loud.
Tough job. Sean, I cut you off. You had something else you wanted to ask.
As far as with the whole thing that was going on with Cuba during that time, which was very powerful, what did George H.W. Bush have any business affiliations in regards to Cuba?
Nothing comes to mind. If he did, it was through through his oil interests. But I'm just not aware of any. Maybe the caller is, but I'm not aware of any.
Yeah.
But again, he blind trusted everything when he came into the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not sure. If the point that the caller is trying to make is that there was some influence, I'm not aware of any.
You know, he's been widely portrayed, Bob, as a decent man.
Right.
Fair.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it always struck me that way.
Great quick story. When I went down to interview him the first time in Houston, I threw my 8-year-old kid on the plane. You know, we had some miles to kill. And I told him on the way, I said, if the former president of the United States doesn't want to talk to you, you're in tough shape, because I'm going to get this interview. Take him in. He's got a little suit on, sits out in the waiting room. And I hear this rumbling voice from the office, and he says, "Where's Green?" And out comes the former president of the United States in shirt sleeves. And I stood up, and I said, "Mr. President," he says, "not you." And he said, "Him." And he points to my son. And my son just bolts up in the chair, and he says, "Come with me." And Secret Service has to wand you before you go into the president's office. And he looks, and he says, "He hasn't got anything." And he goes in, winks at me, and shuts the door. And I've been told, that I had a hard stop at a half hour. And so I'm thinking, my kid's killing my interview.
He's eating your time, isn't he? Yeah.
15 minutes later, Bush comes out and motions me in, and my son's sitting there with soda and a presidential coffee cup. Bush has taken him around and shown him all of the pictures, and Bush talked to me for an hour and gave my son just, you know, the moment of a lifetime.
And he still recalls it, I'm sure.
He still wears the presidential cufflinks to law school.
Okay. What's it like going down to interview a former president like that? What kind of experience was that for you?
You have to get to them. I've interviewed President Bush. I've interviewed President Ford. We interviewed him on several occasions and taught with him. You have to get to them about—
You taught with Gerald Ford?
Yes, out at Chapman University in California. You have to get to them about 6 months— This may be a bit of an exaggeration, but about a year in advance. And then you have to be open to, you know, come tomorrow, you know, get on a plane and come tomorrow.
All right. How did you sell them on the idea that you needed to have time and you deserved to have time with a former president?
Well, this is a shameless plug, Steve, but this series that I have written for—
Plug away. It's a good series.
The series that I've written for sells itself, and I know that— Ford was familiar with it, or even before I went and talked with him, and Bush had been made familiar with it. It's a standard series. It's something that's used in it's in every library. And so when I said that I was writing these books, that was a good entree. And of course, you know, like you had one of the deans of presidential reporting on earlier in the week, Dave Moranis.
Yes.
You know, once you write, you've written 17 books, it gets easier to get your foot in the door. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have more books and they have someone read them, or they read them themselves and find out that you're not carrying a hatchet in your back pocket.
Hey, and so what was it like? How open was he to answering your questions? One of the themes of this book, and you talk about it again, is he was not the most introspective of men, and he's famous almost for that. Right. So what was it like to interview him?
Great book, by the way. I mean, Labor Day giving, you know, it's a Barnes & Noble. Go out and grab one. He was very open. Not as open as President Ford was. Ford would sit back and he would puff his pipe and talk to the ceiling. What you had to do with Bush was, with President Bush, was you would get the prepared answer that you knew that he had given 1,000 times, and you had to have a really good follow, even if the follow was, "What?" And then you would get him into the next stage. What you had to do with him was to keep him talking and get him past the practice line. I mean, these guys are the best interviewees ever. A Romney, an Obama, a Governor Nixon. I mean, these guys have made their living off of being interviewed and giving away nothing.
Well, once you would do the follow-up, would you get a little bit of an introspection, a little bit of sense of, okay, you know what you're talking about, let me give you a better response here?
Yes, because I think that with these guys, and you know this from your reporting, when you don't accept the standard line, you know, they respect you more. If you just sit there and write away and, boy, I'm in the presidential presence and, you know they've got your number.
Well, it's hard not to be sort of in that place with
no
a former president, because you don't want to, you know, you're a former president, you don't want to appear rude in a situation like that. You got to get some, you got to cover some ground, you know.
I knew that it was time to leave President Ford when his dog came running into the room and Valen urinated on the rug. I mean, it was a thoroughly normal situation. When you walk in with a president of the United States, you immediately – there's almost an aura of invincibility that you have to poke through.
Yes.
Don't you get this with politicians?
Absolutely.
Because they want it to be that way. Now, with the president.
But particularly presidents, though.
With the president,
it's almost like you can – it's hard to punch through it. It's so thick.
It is. And I've found that you do that with follow-up questions. You just let them say their piece. You let them read the press release that's in their mind, and then you don't accept it. And if they move you on, then you think, yes, Mr. President, and I'm not going to get what I want. You really can't unless you are – you know, unless you're Morley Safe or Dan Rather or somebody who's used to punching them around.
Mm-hmm.
You don't punch back to the President of the United States. Plus, you don't do it as a scholar.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a journalist. I'm a scholar, and I want long-range answers.
Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888, the presidency of the first George Bush is our topic today. John Robert Green, author of a very good book on the president, is our guest. Again, 816-235-2888. David from Midtown, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to say about President Bush, the first one, that I had a tremendous amount of respect for him until he nominated Clarence Thomas to replace Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's equivalent to him nominating a Jewish person who didn't believe in Israel's right to exist to, you know, represent the Jewish faith.
Oh, you're 100% correct that that was one of the main things in 1991. I mean, Bush was that hurt him. Bush was not going to get a high percentage of the black vote anyway. But what he did in that and how he handled it was he squandered away any hope of gaining in the gender gap, mm-hmm. and with women because of the issue of sexual harassment. Whether you believe Anita Hill or not, and it is an open question, by the way. Despite several books that have looked into it and have come down on the side of Anita Hill, said all this really happened and Clarence Thomas really is that way. You know, there's some evidence to suggest that Clarence Thomas was pushed into having the hearings reopened by the White House,
mm-hmm.
and he felt like he was, you know, had a spit and was being rolled on the fire. But it didn't matter because women abandoned Bush and went right to Bill Clinton.
Bob, did the president know about those allegations prior to the nomination?
No, they were all completely blindsided. It's another example of bad Bush White House staff work.
So why did the president pick Clarence Thomas for that very important position?
Actually, very simple. Thurgood Marshall had resigned. He had to have a black. He had to have a black conservative. Clarence Thomas was the only one.
Wow.
The only one. That's why Clarence Thomas got the nod, and he was badly vetted.
David, there you go, David.
Thank you,
David.
Yeah, thanks for the call. And that nomination haunted him, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And he's, you know, liberals are still giving Bush the blame for turning the court that far right. I think Bush is sleeping very comfortably with what the court is doing up to and probably excluding the decision a couple of weeks ago on Obamacare.
He's been a vote that the president would have counted on
yes.
as conservative all yes. along, ever yeah. since, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Even more so David Souter, who he brought on earlier.
Let's talk about his upbringing, because he is the son of a U.S. senator, Prescott
right.
Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Did George Bush have – was he going to be a politician from the get-go in his life? Or
no.
How did that play out?
No. In fact, if you look at Bush's upbringing, it's not the traditional conservative Republican upbringing, because Prescott Bush was a moderate to a progressive Republican who committed the cardinal sin of 1950s Republican politics. He went out after Joe McCarthy.
Right.
But no, George Bush wanted to break away from the mold. First step that he took was to defy his father or go against his father's wishes and sign up for the Navy in 1941 at age 17.
Why did that defy his father's wishes?
His father didn't want him to get killed.
Mm.
This was a family that could have kept him out of World War II. We look back at it now and it's like everybody served. But there were families of means like the Bushes who could have kept him out
and
if they wanted to.
The war almost killed him.
He was shot out of his Mustang, his Mustang airplane over Chichijima. His tail gunner and wingman were killed. There's several stories on that, but the one that makes the most sense is that their parachutes didn't work. Bush goes into the Pacific Ocean.
He ejects out of the plane.
He ejects out.
Which is a scary proposition.
I've got pictures that I'll show people tonight of him being dragged out of the water onto the USS Finback.
What kind of shape was he in?
He looks like he has just been through a blender, which he had been. He was in his life raft for, I forget the hours, 12, 14 hours.
Wow.
In shark-infested waters. But you want shark-infested waters, you know, go to Texas. You know, the guy, when he goes back, he does Yale, graduates, and then completely defies his father's wishes, and he goes wildcatting. Mm-hmm. You know, he goes to Midland, Texas. He's set up by his father, who had contacts at Dresser.
What is wildcatting? Describe what that business is, because
Stick a drill in the ground and hope the oil comes up.
And he's good at it because he's a millionaire by the age of 40.
He is very good at it. He has very good advice. He's well staked by his father. You know, this isn't a kid going down there without a dime in his pocket. You know, this is more along the lines of a J.R. Ewing. You know, someone going down and really striking it big. And you have to think back to the 1950s and the golden age of oil in Oklahoma and in Texas. Mm-hmm. And it was the chance of a lifetime. It was the chance he could make his own way, he could make a gazillion dollars, and it was fun. George Bush loved a good adventure. I mean, and this was a guy who had just been shot at in World War II. He's not gonna work, you know, for Smith Barney.
Mm-hmm. And he loved a good adventure. That has continued throughout his life because even these days, at least until a few years ago, he was still jumping out of airplanes, right?
There's in Brent Scowcroft's office, there's a picture on Scowcroft's desk. He has only one picture of George Bush. This was a few years ago, but he had only one picture of George Bush. And it's Bush jumping out of the airplane, and he's coming down on his – holding on to the tethers of the – and it's signed – I can't say how it's signed on family radio. He calls himself a name, which was probably what Barbara called him for jumping out of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny. You go into offices like that and you say, where are all the pictures? You know, there's only the one. But this is a guy who has written with him and seen him every day. He doesn't need pictures. And the one that he chose is Bush jumping out of an airplane at age 80.
Let's go to Robert from Kansas City, Missouri. Robert, you're on Up to Date with John Robert Green. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'm trying to react to the statement that David said earlier, the last caller,
mm-hmm.
about Bush losing black votes because of the appointment of Clarence Thomas and mm-hmm. all this stuff. Bush is a principled man. I'm not Republican, but Bush is a principled man, and he is a conservative. If he was going to appoint somebody who was going to balance the court or give the conservative point of view, I don't think that Clarence Thomas has disappointed so far. The man stayed within his vision of having appointing a conservative man. So the fact that he didn't appoint Clarence Thomas, I don't care for Clarence Thomas, but I think it does not diminish Bush's credentials as a conservative.
No, it doesn't. Diminish his credentials as a conservative, Robert. He picked a conservative black. It really diminishes his judgment as a politician,
mm-hmm.
because there was a moment there. He had gone through the committee hearings. He had come out, and they were about to take it to the Senate floor, and then the Anita Hill thing explodes. The president has the option. There's a word that presidents don't use really all that often in public, and the word is no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has the option of withdrawing the appointment. But one of the things that is so characteristic of George Bush, but also hurt him in many instances, was his loyalty. He gets in with someone and he stays with them. And despite some of his staff members saying, stop the nomination and we'll put forth a moderate white Republican like David Souter,
mm-hmm.
or a woman that the Democrats will take, Bush stuck with him and stuck with him through some of the slimiest, seamiest hearings, you know, in congressional history. And that hurt him in the election, not appointing a conservative.
You know, we're sitting here talking about this president who jumps out of airplanes. He was shot out of an airplane in the war. He likes to have a good time. And yet, Bob, he was tagged with this label of being an elitist.
Right.
It hung on him like leaves hang on trees. I mean, where did that come from, and why could he never shake it?
He couldn't shake it because he didn't really want to. I mean, this is a guy who, when he ran his first congressional campaign in Texas, would not stop wearing button-down shirts, even though he was told to.
So he looked like an elitist.
Well, he looked like what he was, which was he was a businessman who had been raised in Connecticut and educated at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who keeps Pork Rinds and Oak Ridge Boy tapes in his limousine. You know, and there's Herb Parmit's biography. I think the subtitle of his biography of Bush is Lone Star Yankee. And there's both these parts to George Bush. There's the button-down Brooks brothers who did not know how to work a scanner. right. in the middle of the campaign. But there's also this guy who will get up and play a guitar with Lee Atwater, who is a down home boy and whose favorite, still apparently, whose favorite mode of exercise is playing horseshoes.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, George Bush installed horseshoe pits at the White House, and there was nothing about that that was phony. All of Reagan's stuff, you know, chopping wood, you know, that was all posed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was Peggy. It was Peggy Noonan who said that George Bush was in many ways the real Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm. Hey, how is his health today? Do you have any feel for that? How he's doing?
I have no firsthand knowledge
because
on
today
his health,
he's
but I've seen him in a wheelchair. In pictures.
Oh, is that right?
I haven't spoken with the former president for almost a decade.
Which has got to be difficult for him, you would think.
Yes. Oh, I would think so.
Late 80s now?
You know how many times I'm asked that, and then I got to do the math. And yeah. How about we just say he's late 80s?
Yeah, he's getting up there, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, listen, again, John Robert Green speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza. More information for that event, kclibrary.org. Man, you were just great. I sure enjoyed having you here.
It has been a great time. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, again, that's author John Robert Green.